Well, welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast project on rethinking sex ed. I try each week, as you know, to post some thoughts that'll help get a conversation started about hammering out a viable, a helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality, because what we've been doing hasn't been working. And I really do hope you'll join in and comment. And I do thank those many who have, because at the end of the book, or at the end of the project, we're going to turn what we learned together into a book. So let's begin. Let's begin this week's episode. The title is Masturbation, a Handy Talk for Kids. Because I talk to a lot of people about life, I talk to a lot of people about sex. Sex is an integral part of life. And as I've been working on this project, I've probably been inviting even more of those talks about sex than normal. I ask people about the hard topics, what's difficult to talk to their young people about. And masturbation is first on the list for a lot of people. And when it comes up, two questions usually come up. First, is masturbation a sin? And second, what do I say to my kids about masturbation? Which the subset of that question is, how do I talk to boys? How do I talk to girls? Is it the same? Is it different? Now, the first question may not be relevant for you if you didn't grow up in church. But if you did, it's a thing. A lot of people learned when they were young that masturbation is a sin, and sin is kind of a deal for church folks. So let's talk first about the masturbation and sin question. If this episode ended up saying, yep, masturbation is a sin, then there wouldn't be much need to go on further, because we would just tell our kids, yep, it's a sin, don't do it. It'll make you grow hair on your palms, you'll go blind, easy, we're done. Now, of course, they'll masturbate anyway. They'll just feel bad about it afterwards. And if they're good kids, they'll try and repress their desire, maybe even carry sexual repression into their futures, and we could do that if masturbation is a sin. Well, you can probably tell what I think. I think calling masturbation a sin is not helpful. I think it's actually detrimental. In fact, I've seen it cause problems again and again. I was speaking to a young man some time ago who'd fallen into this horrible spiral of toxic thought and self-destructive practices. Some of his troubles had run him afoul of the law and were limiting his employment possibilities, so he was working at a dead-end job, his relationships were in emotional turmoil, his life had shrunk down to going to a dead-end job and then playing video games to pass the time. His hope was dim, his prospects were dimmer, his life really was on the skids, and so we spoke. And we spoke, of course, about the spiritual dynamic of redemption and how to tap into that in our lives. But as he was telling me his story, something struck me. As is often the case, life troubles were mixed in with sex troubles, and masturbation had actually been the starting point for a real downward turn in this cycle for him. He'd grown up in a church that taught him that masturbation was a sin, that God was displeased and was cooking up some punishment for him because, again, masturbation is a sin. And so naturally, reared in this belief, he resisted masturbation. And resisted, and resisted, and resisted, until he couldn't resist anymore, and then he would, quote, stumble and fall. Those were his words. And once that happened, he told me, it was kind of like the cat was out of the bag. What the hell, he said, let's cut loose the three-ring circus. And all kinds of sexual and substance debauchery ensued, because again, what the hell? If he was already debased before God, in for a penny, in for a pound. Once the sin threshold was broken, why not ride depravity as far as it would take him and see what would happen? Because once God decides he's going to punish you, could the punishment be much worse for going the whole nine yards? Well, I really felt for this young man who really had been suckered in by this kind of toxic thinking. He was from a tradition that had taught him that there is a sin, there is a not sin standard, and it was a pretty unrealistic one at that. It made the need to offload sexual hormones a sin. And given his all or nothing personality, I've got a personality like that, so I think I sympathized. Once he crossed the all line and went into nothing territory, well, might as well go all in. When religious teachers paint masturbation with a broad stroke and call it sin, two things. First, they usually do it ignorant of the dirty sex instincts that we picked up 1800 years ago. That's that whole extensive part we looked at in part two of this project. Second, even though our understanding is uninformed, we religious teachers tend to speak with certitude and authority. So we throw the word sin around as though we were speaking with the backing of God, and we do it with very little regard to the horrible effects that it can have in the lives of our young people. But before I just say categorically that calling masturbation a sin is detrimental, a little background. Again, people have been asking me the question about sin and masturbation for about 25 years. Pretty early on, I realized that to untangle it for folks, I'd have to first untangle the whole idea of sin. I wrote a book. It's called Rethinking Our Story, Can We Still Be Christian in the Quantum Era? I've got a whole section in that book about rethinking the visceral instincts that we carry about sin and redemption. And if that is a pressing concern for you, I really would encourage you to have a read. You can get it at Amazon, again, Rethinking Our Story. Especially read the section that's titled Rethinking What Happened. That is an exploration of our whole idea of sin and salvation. But for this episode, just some quick remarks. For several centuries, church folk have latched on to some really unhelpful ideas about what sin is. We've tended to reduce sin to a list of bad actions. Lying, that's a sin. So is cheating and stealing and fornicating and the rest of the list. We also carry an unconscious image of God around inside of us. God is an old man out there somewhere watching us, seeing us sinning and writing it down on a list. And oh no, Johnny is masturbating over there. That's on the naughty list for sure. It's a sin. So now Johnny's in trouble. And like a stern parent, now God will have to whack Johnny. Maybe something bad will happen in his life. Or maybe God will just record his dirty little sin in his ledger and whack him later, maybe in the afterlife. Now, it sounds silly when we say it out loud, but that narrative runs in the background for a lot of church folk. And it's just a bad, bad way to think about sin. It's a tragically reductionist way of thinking because it reduces us to misbehaving children and God to an authoritarian, punishing parent. Sin's a problem, it really is, but it's not that kind of problem. Sin is a problem of a false sense of self. It's a problem of blindnesses and illusions we believe to be true. It's a problem of toxic instincts that betray us and not seeing that they are running in the background of our lives. It's a problem of settling for a lesser way of being human, but it can't be reduced to a set of bad behaviors that engender divine punishment. Now again, I've written and spoken at length on this point, but here's just a Cliff Notes version. In the Christian tradition, sin is not a big deal. Grace is a big deal. Mercy is a big deal. Forgiveness is a big deal. That's the whole story of the life and the teaching of Jesus. Consequently, bad behaviors, while they hurt us and while they hurt those that we love, really have no bearing on our acceptance before God. They have no bearing on whether God punishes or doesn't punish us. Grace is the really big deal in the Christian narrative. Grace is how we find our way out of a reductionist way of being. Grace is how we find our way into what Jesus called the fullness of life or an abundant life. And once that story gets settled deep inside of us, once the narrative of grace and redemption as the epicenter of the Christian story, once that gets established deep in our understanding of the spiritual life, well, the sin or not sin question isn't even relevant about masturbation. The better question to ask ourselves is, does masturbation hurt us? Does it hurt those that we love? Is masturbation healthy or is it unhealthy? Is it helpful or is it unhelpful? The sin question isn't really the relevant question. And I think the answer to both of those questions, healthy or unhealthy, is yes. Masturbation can be healthy. And masturbation can be unhealthy. It can be helpful, and it can be unhelpful. Which kind of brings us to the second question that people often ask me about masturbation. How do we think about it, and how do we talk about it with our kids? Now, first off, we have to acknowledge in these conversations how we have thought about masturbation ourselves. That can't help but inform how we talk to our young people. So before we talk to them about this, it serves us well to go back and do an internal inquiry into our own masturbation history. Did we, during our formative years, did we think that we were doing something bad? Did we think that we were displeasing God? Was God watching us? Was God taking notes? Was God preparing punishment? If so, we'll probably have a hard time not bringing all of those unarticulated instincts into any conversation that we have with our kids. So our starting place, before even talking to our kids, is to do an assessment of the emotional context that we bring to the discussion. Now, this is a tough subject for you. You probably grew up on the conservative side of the religious spectrum. If that's the case, on that side of the spectrum, James Dobson wrote a book called Preparing for Adolescence. So there in the most conservative of the traditions, he says that owing to how little the Bible actually has to say about it, he concludes you just shouldn't feel guilty about it. It's not a sin. So you can read that if that's part of your experience. That being said, for folks who deal with church and sin, after all these years of dealing with the issue, I've come to a framework that I think is helpful for talking to our kids. We begin by acknowledging the fiery nature of sexual hunger. That's point one in a conversation I would want to have with kids about masturbation. We acknowledge the fiery nature of sexual hunger and we affirm that it is good. We start by affirming out loud with words spoken to our children that the fieriness of their sexual desire is why we humans exist. Our ancestors felt the same burning sexual hunger that we do, and it inflamed their blood just like it does ours. It consumed their drives and desires just like it does ours, and so they had sex, and then they had babies, and we are here. Fiery sexual hunger, it's good. It's what got us here. And our ancestors' genes are in us, so the fiery hunger is not a sin. It's normal, it's natural, it's developmentally appropriate, it's biologically appropriate. That's where we begin any talk about masturbation. Our heated, passionate hunger for sexuality is good, really good, existentially good. And if we talk to them early enough, they won't have felt the fire yet, so we get to tell them what a wonderful feeling it will be and that it is one of the great parts of growing up and that they're really going to like it. And if they still think that boys or girls have cooties, we tell them that they will come when they'll want those cooties all over their bodies and that will also be good. Fiery sexual desire is good. Now, the next point in this conversation I want to have with kids is to tell them that there is a time and there is a place for all that fiery passion to be expressed. And so we tell them that the passion is like a real fire. At the right time and the right place, it can warm the house, but at the wrong time, at the wrong place, it can burn the house down. Which means, we tell them, there's going to be a little bit of tricky timing ahead. When I spoke to my kids, I put a personal face on it. I told them that I faced this tricky dilemma, that mom did, that all people do. The problem, we tell them, is that when we want the closest kind of closeness that there is, and we want it as badly as we've ever wanted anything, unfortunately for most of us, we won't be ready yet. So we reiterate the important processes that get us ready to handle this fire of passion. Again, that's the part that we looked at in section two. We reaffirm that these processes take time, which means that you, young person, and the boy or girl that you're going to want to touch and feel, you're not going to be ready yet for that kind of touch. So what are you going to do? You'll have this fire raging in your belly, but you won't yet be ready to use it. You'll be in kind of an in-between zone. Your body will be ready for sexual touch, but your brain and your heart and your life won't be. Your brain might tell you that you're ready, you might think that you're ready, but a whole lot of people have gone down this path before, and we all stand here in this line to tell you, no, you're not ready yet. The wisdom that we can offer our young people is the wisdom of soon, but not yet. Your life is not ready yet. But, we tell them, there's some good news to help you out. There's a way to keep the fire from burning you up, and it's masturbation. As you get near puberty, that's when we start to talk to them. When they get near that stage, we tell them how to masturbate. They learn it from us, from the people who love them. And we tell them what an orgasm is like. We tell them what happens to their bodies when an orgasm happens. When I spoke to my kids this way, I told them that masturbation could be like food rations during hard times. I told them to imagine themselves stranded in a snowstorm. They couldn't get warm food, cooked food, delicious food. But, I told them, if you can't get tasty foods, once you're hungry enough, you'll be really happy to get any kind of food. Canned food would be good. Dried food would be good. I told them about an extended fast that I went on one time. After several days of fasting, I was reading a book in which one of the characters was complaining, and the only food that was available to him was turnip soup. And sitting there several days into this fast, I would have loved some turnip soup. I was hungry for turnip soup. My mind was filled with delicious imaginings about turnip soup. While you are waiting, we can tell our children, While you're waiting for your own readiness and the readiness of your partner, while you're waiting for the kind of relationship in which you can experience your deepest sexual desires, you can have soup and maybe some crackers. It won't be your favorite thing, but it'll take care of your hunger and it'll keep your pants from exploding. So first, in this conversation, we want our kids to understand that the fiery hunger of their sexual passion is good, very good. Second, we help them understand that timing, being what it is, and growth and the psycho-emotional preparedness that takes the time that it does, masturbation gives them a way to help themselves last the time that it takes. Third, in this conversation, while we're talking to them about masturbation, we're also talking to them about the broader relational context into which human sexuality fits. We talk about the kind of men and the kind of women that we want to be able to sustain the sexual journey. We talk about the shared, committed, growing, and faithful life. We talk about all the stages of lovemaking that we outlined in part one. We reinforce how eroticism is only part of the sexual experience. Boys especially are overwhelmed by the beauty of women's bodies, all of their womanliness and all of its curviness. So we talk to them about seeing more than a woman's sexual parts. We talk to them about the importance of not reducing women to their bodies or objectifying them. We talk about seeing a bigger picture than physical attraction. We help them see how the marketing engine of our society has betrayed us and set unrealistic standards of physical beauty that causes us to miss some of the most important parts of potential partners, their souls, their characters, their virtue, their dreams and desires, their hopes. One of the more effective conversations I had with my boys was to speak with them about how sexually attractive their sister was. I used the kind of derogatory language that young men often use about young women, and I was really glad, relieved actually, that they were deeply offended by my language. Well, I went on to talk about how every girl is somebody's sister, how every girl is somebody's daughters, and that if we reduce women to boobs and butts, or when our primary focus is on getting into their pants, we distort the wholeness that is a young woman and distort our own souls in the process. And it is in this context that we teach our young people that masturbation allows us to offload some of the pressure that builds up in our bodies. We talk about how masturbation helps us keep our eyes on a bigger picture and look forward toward the full sexual journey. All the life stage when sex chemicals make it really hard to think about anything else in our minds at all, masturbation helps us keep our eye on the bigger picture. So again, first, we affirm that our kids' sexual hunger is strong and good. Second, we help them understand the time required to lay the foundation necessary for long-term sexual fulfillment and about how masturbation gives them the time that they need. Third, we continually put masturbation into the context of the larger sexual journey. We teach our kids the bigger lessons of sexual wisdom and the importance of timing and pacing. We talk about body image and seeing potential sexual partners as more than objects. We help them assign appropriate value and weight to their sexual experience and to their bodies. Now, it's important to note that things are different for young girls in our society than they are for boys. There can be, and this is especially true in church circles, there can be a double standard. That double standard shows up lots of ways, but in particular it shows up around masturbation. Church folk or conservative folk often assume that young girls not having the same kind of sexual drive and the drive to masturbate just simply shouldn't. Now maybe that's because of the lingering effects of those second century insertions into the Western tradition about the shamefulness of female sexuality. Not many people would say it out loud, but somehow shame is more a part of a young girl's sexual experience in our society than it is boys. Shame is just in the air. And because it is, many young girls, especially religious girls, never experiment with their bodies, and they never learn how their sexual equipment works, which means we need to give our young girls a bit more unpacking. When we talk to young girls about masturbation, our focus is to grant them freedom to explore their bodies without the toxic overlay of any female shaming that they picked up from our history. We want them to grow up open and free with their sexuality so that they can know what gives them pleasure, so that they can enter into a sexual relationship and be comfortable teaching their partners about their bodies. In that Survey Monkey, or one of the Survey Monkeys that I sent out before this project, one woman posted this. I'll just read it to you. Doug, I hope that when you do this project, you'll teach young women about orgasms. I hope you'll teach them, and young men too, that orgasms don't happen as quickly or as easily for women as they do with young men. One thing I wish I had done is learn how to have an orgasm alone before I had a partner. I wish I'd read a book on how to do it and then practiced until I was good at it. That way I could have taught my husband what to do. We were naive together, and while I cherished the learning that we did together, we had a lot of trouble. There was shame, there was embarrassment, there was ignorance, and it was so difficult that we thought there was something wrong with us, especially me. Now, if I'd been taught that it was okay to masturbate, and if I'd been instructed and experienced with orgasms beforehand, it would have made things a whole lot easier. So tell them that. Tell parents that, Doug. And by the way, also tell them that real women don't look like porn stars, and that porn stars are acting. And even when women do have orgasms, it's not going to be like that. So here I am telling you what she said. Another mother responded with her story about speaking to her daughter about masturbation, and I asked for her permission to include it here because I think it was a really healthy way to bring this subject up with our kids. Here's her story. My daughter got into the car one day complaining about family planning module in her health class. Ever the responsible mother, I jumped right in. Family planning, really? Birth control, the pill, condoms? No, Mom. We're learning how to do a checkbook. Oh. Well, what do you know about that other stuff? Do you know about birth control? What do you know about orgasms? Does anyone ever talk about that? Orgasms? No, not really. But from what I've heard, I think they hurt. That, the mom said, was when I knew that I had failed as a parent. Oh, no, honey, orgasms don't hurt. Actually, just the opposite. They feel really good. She was surprised. Oh, I thought it hurt. But really, we can stop talking about this now, Mom. Hold on, sweetie. You need to know about orgasms. It doesn't only happen during sexual intercourse. It also happens for some people when they're sleeping or when you make it happen by yourself. Mom. Seriously, it's actually kind of spectacular. It's a thing your body can do that feels incredible. Orgasms will be part of your sexual life, and when you're ready, you're going to want orgasms. Also, it won't be long now before boys will want to put their hands all over your body. Mom. No, really. You better wrap your head around this one, because believe it or not, you might actually want them to put their hands all over your body. You might even want to put your hands on their bodies. Oh, Mom. Now, I know it creeps you out now, but one day it won't. It creeps you out now because it's not time, but one day it will be time. And when it is, we should talk again. And by the way, there's some really good reasons not to rush this hands-on-the-body thing. We'll talk about that again. But in the meantime, you really should know about making orgasms happen for yourself. Mom, this is making me really uncomfortable. I know, right? It is uncomfortable. You know what Granny told me? She told me it's magical. She told me it's wonderful. She told me it's beautiful. But then my friend up the street told me that when a boy pulls on his penis until he pees everywhere, that's what an orgasm is. Not so magical now, huh, Granny? Oh, Mom, that's just gross. Well, sure, when you say it that way, it is. But like I said, it's a pretty awesome thing that our bodies can do. And in the end, Granny turned out to be right. It really is a magical thing once you understand it. Now, masturbating, that's a safe way for you to try your body out. You can have an orgasm with nobody else touching your body. You just decide you want an orgasm to happen, and you touch your own body until it does. You'll figure out pretty amazingly what your body can do, and you'll do it all on your own. And later, much, much later, you'll be ready to experience orgasms with someone that you love deeply. By then, if you practice on your own, you'll know how everything works. Okay, Mom, I get it. And when you're ready to know more, you can come talk to me, or you can come talk to Dad. Dad? Oh, God, no. Seriously, you, not Dad. Now, I can't imagine a much better way to talk to our kids than this mom's approach. She normalized communication about sexuality even when it was awkward. It is uncomfortable, right? But she kept talking anyway. That's what we do. We keep affirming that sexual feelings are good. We keep saying that masturbation is a way to learn our bodies. We keep talking about being ready for a sexual relationship. We keep giving the broader context for sexuality. It was a really good way to talk about it. Finally, we need to give our young people a couple of caveats about masturbation. As we said earlier, masturbation can be healthy and it can be unhealthy. It can be helpful, it can be unhelpful. One of the pitfalls is settling for masturbation. It's been a recurring theme in this podcast that sexual relationships are tough. They demand hard work, relational work, interior growth. To have the erotic part of sex go well requires that we also be working on conflict resolution and the pragma part of life building and so forth. Masturbation doesn't require any of that. It doesn't require any of the hard work required of real sexual relationships. In other words, masturbation can blunt the energy and the drive that pushes us to make the deep connections in our lives that are the place for sexuality to unfold. Settling for masturbation can dull our internal determination to push for the kind of relationship we really want, intimate, vulnerable, transparent. It can blunt our internal determination for eros and philos and pragma and agape. Masturbation is easy. You don't have to deal with another person, which can lure us into not pushing or not searching. It can lure us into not learning or conflicting or resolving those conflicts. So don't, we want to tell our young people, don't settle. A second pitfall is this. We can come to depend on masturbation to help us deal with non-sexual struggles. Masturbation feels good. It releases brain chemicals that fuel a strong motivation drive. Food does the same. A couple of beers will do the same. Masturbation triggers the dopamine motivation cycle. As we come to understand more about the brain, the more we realize that addiction is built into everybody's wiring. A lot of things that are good for us release feel-good chemicals. That's the dopamine part. And when our mood is bad, we do something to bump up the chemicals that make us feel good. We evolve to do this. People who feel good are motivated, and motivated people get out there and do what needs to be done. And those who do what needs to be done tend to survive, and they tend to survive, and then they tend to mate. And they pass their genes on to their kids, and that's the process we've seen so many times. The genes that drive this chemical motivation process get concentrated and wired more strongly into each successive generation. So, if something elevates these feel-good chemicals in our brains, like comfort food, like eating sweet or fatty foods, or getting the affirmation from others, or masturbating, our brains are wired to gravitate toward it to bump ourselves up anytime our mood is low. Anything that will boost the feel-good chemicals, and a lot of things will, is subject to addictive overuse. We experience the chemical surge, we feel better, and we want to do the thing again to help us feel better again. And each time we repeat the activity, we strengthen the habit pathways in our brains, making it more likely that we'll do it again and again and again. And at some point, we have to be careful that we don't cross a line where the motivation cycle isn't working for our well-being as it does in healthy expressions of masturbation, but can actually begin to work against it. But by the time that we realize that we're smoking too much dope, or we're eating too many chocolates, or we're depending on masturbation to avoid life's difficulties, by then the habit wiring is set, and the brain infrastructure keeps drawing us back into familiar territory again and again and again. A kind of brain chemical dependency can set in that causes us to count on masturbation to help us feel good and to use masturbation not to explore our bodies and not to ease our fiery sexual desire, but to get a little bit of feel good to help us avoid having to deal with whatever feel bad that life is dealing us. In which case, masturbation becomes a strategy for hiding from our troubles instead of dealing with them. So those are a couple of pitfalls that we want to help our young people avoid. We don't want masturbation to lure them into settling, and we don't want masturbation to become a tool for avoiding the uncomfortable things that need to be addressed head on. But if we teach them to avoid these pitfalls, masturbation can be like food rations when we don't have what we really want. They can help us get in touch with our own bodies so that we're ready for a sexual relationship when the time is right. And really, how beautiful is that? One of the young men in our community in his sexually mature but not ready for relationship years, he and his family have given me permission to ask him all the time how he's doing with his sexual fire. So I asked him the question, as I do often. It's the same question I asked my kids when they were growing up. How are you doing with the fire? And when I ask him, he talks about it pretty frankly. Recently told me he is thankful for what he's learned about masturbation. It's not what I want most deeply, he said. I want a woman to share my life with. I want a woman to share my body with. But not yet. Right now I want to get ready for life and prepare for a career and experience travel and music. I want to see things. I want to go places. I want to get ready for the future. So until I'm ready for a relationship, emergency rations are doing the trick. I can go a while on soup and crackers. When I hear that, I relax a bit, because how our children handle their sexuality, this is a constant concern for those of us who love them so deeply. So there's the chat. 4 points on talking about masturbation. What are you thinking? What's stirring up in your heart? What do you think about this approach to teaching masturbation to our young people? And as always, post your thoughts either on the Facebook page or at DougHammock.com. I'd love to hear from you.